everybody. We're here to talk about the Fall Guy. And I'm excited to talk about this with my lovely panel of Earth's Mightiest Critics. I think it's going to be a really fun discussion. More fun for me, probably, than the experience of watching The Fall Guy, directed
That's
by David Leitch.
That's not a teaser at all. That's not a teaser at all.
Hey, I'm putting it all out there. You got to set the table. I don't want to be here for 6 hours. We're just going to dive right into
podcast.
Right. No, not quite. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, the movie felt like it was 6 hours. But anyhow, I'm just putting it out there. So, yeah, we're talking about the newest vehicle starring Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, hot off of last summer's Barbenheimer. You'd think this is a movie magic formula, a blockbuster in the making. We shall see, I guess. Time will tell, because the opening weekend certainly didn't. It barely crawled to, I don't think it made
28 million.
Right? They were hoping it would cross the 40 million line, this $120 million blockbuster. Now, numbers don't necessarily mean anything, but sometimes they absolutely do. So who is talking about this tonight? Me, Ian Simmons from Kicking the Seat. Mike Crowley, if you'll probably agree, Don Shanahan of Film Obsessive and Every Movie Has a Lesson, and the Cinephile Hissy Fit podcast, Jeff York, the Establishing Shot, Mark the Movie Man Krawcheck, aka the Unknown Movie Man, from Social Mark Productions. And I gotta give a shout out, she could not join us tonight. Katie Glidewell, the blonde in front, is feeling a bit under the weather, so she's taking some rest, which is unfortunate, because I know she was going to be perhaps the staunchest of the staunch defenders of this film. So I don't know if we're missing out or if we're sparing her feelings by not subjecting her to our nonsense. But let me just say, I only know the opinion on this movie of one of the other panelists, and that would be Jeff York.
Okay.
The other folks, I don't know if I've seen your reactions or I haven't like paid real attention to them, because I try and go into these things relatively cold. But Jeff, I mean, your take was unmissable. So let's see.
You gotta start with that one. Then. I mean, tease that right there.
No. I want to go around the table and get the cut, read the room, as it were. So Don, high level reaction to The Fall Guy.
The movie is entertaining enough to be fine. It's a good summer blockbuster. You like what you want it to be. You want I know we're talking about the box office fallout, where like, what do people really want? What are people willing to spend their money on? And is this worth going to theater for? This is a good big screen blockbuster kind of thing, where you can do worse for, unfortunately, $19.99 prices of $4 to $6. Like, but yeah, if you're trying to pull a family of four for, you know, a nice soft PG-13 kind of thing that has a little bit of mayhem here, mayhem there. Dropping $12, maybe not so much. But for me, the first 40 minutes of the movie, I don't want to say unassailable, but I was damn entertained. I tell you what, like the relationship dynamics between Gosling and Blunt played out through Bullhorn, you know, on a movie set. And you kind of like, you have the little the wrinkle of like, oh, we need to find our star, you know, all of that can work a little bit. And I don't know the TV show to a T, but like, seems like it fits the modus operandi of that, where, you know, a guy has to moonlight and do a few other little side things to make things work, even if it's a little bit more intimate as in finding his actual stunt, you know, or his actor double, so to speak. All that I can work with and put some hijinks and sue action in there. Once a dead body shows up, and now we're like, oh, darn, somebody's dead.
Don, sorry,
you
know? Don.
Oh, that's in the trailer.
You're not a trailer guy, Don, so you wouldn't know. But yeah, that's literally like the catalyst in the trailer.
So I didn't watch the trailer. So I get to that part of the movie, I'm like, so we're killing motherfuckers now. Thanks to the banner. Once we get to there, I think the light pitter and banter that could be a fun movie, and you said it in the, this could be like a workplace comedy if you just hang around in a movie set and watch these, everyone bust each other's balls, heal each other's little scars, and find, you know, and they have the little like, well, where's our star, you know? This could be easy and breezy fun, and it was for 45 minutes. But once we're like covering up dead bodies and like trying to sweep things under the rug, and the, you know, the producer just, nothing good's going to come from that. Therefore, we're never, at some point the fun has to end, because, you know, it's, even if you like save the movie production by the big scheme of chasing the thing, everyone's lives are ruined because a murder happened on your set. You're never going to get hired again. You know, like this is if you want a sustainable thing that could be a small little franchise or even like the TV show where you have a repeatable success kind of fun here, you don't get it because this is a one and done kind of thing. And that's a shame because for a while there, you got something going with good chemistry and two good stars. So I was good for half of it. Then I was, you know, lost for the other half. So.
Okay. That's fair. Yeah. Sort of similar reactions on my end, but not nearly as rosy. And part of that gets down to the trailer, but we'll talk about that in a bit.
Sure.
Mark, you, speaking of the trailer, we talked about this for weeks, how I was really jazzed by the teaser for The Fall Guy. And I was like, I really want to see this movie. I'm excited for it. And you were like, I don't want to watch The Fall Guy. It doesn't look interesting to me. You famously put it to the group in a private chat saying, do I see the Phantom Menace re-release or The Fall Guy? And I said, famously, see The Fall Guy for purely selfish reasons and apologies in advance. Were those apologies warranted, or are you a cheerleader for Gosling and Blunt or Blossling?
I loved everything that didn't deal with the romance. And that may sound cold and like a guy angle, but it's the absolute truth. Is that I never felt the romance between Gosling and Blunt ever. And it's not to their detriment. They tried. Yeah. The dialogue for them, for their parts, was so clunky and felt so mishandled. I loved this director. My oldest son, who I literally like 10 minutes ago, just got back from getting him from college. He graduated from college and all that. He loves Bullet Train. Bullet Train is one of his favorite films. I loved Bullet Train. The action sequence parts of this film, and even I like the plot where with the missing actor, loved all that bits of it. I enjoyed the action, the ridiculous action scenes. Okay, I know what you're going for. I loved all of those bits. When we get to the bits where it's the dialogue and the setup between Blunt and Gosling's characters, it felt so out of place. And also what you guys talk about with the first half of this film and second half of this film, I didn't know what type of film I was supposed to be watching because there's the romance angle, but there's also some of the meta stuff in here that I was like, if the whole film was kind of going for this angle, that's great. But we're throwing everything at the wall to see which pasta sticks. And for me, the pasta that stuck was the action stuff, was for him looking into where the missing guy was, the twist, even as convoluted as it was, the twist with the setup of the actor of why he was missing, the whole reason behind that, and the producer being in on it. I loved all of that, because if you watch the TV show, and this is what confused me, TV show, it's about a stuntman who moonlights as a bounty hunter. Yeah. How do you not just run with that idea for a feature film?
Would it be so simple? How I forget three fines line from.
And you could.
Oh my God, Mark.
Would that it were
Mark, so simple? I hate to cut you off, Mark, but I've never seen The Fall Guy.
No,
I knew that Lee Majors was in it, but I didn't know what the plot. I thought it was just like a stuntman action show. Stuntman slash bounty hunter. That sounds great. And I think even if you wanted to play the meta angle, you could do something like with Gosling reprising his role as the driver from Drive, because I mean that's what he was doing in that movie. Not the bounty hunting part, but I'm even angrier now than I was before.
Here we go.
And again, it's no fault of
your mouthpiece.
I like Gosling. I like Blunt. I actually like what they were trying to do. It was nothing with their performances. It was nothing, but it was in part the direction and especially the dialogue. When you get into the romantical dialogue between these two, it felt like they were just stumbling over them, like it was written by someone else who inserted this romance dialogue into this action, kind of action mystery film, you know, that was having some meta fun. And it sounds bad, and it's not because I don't like romance. I love a good romance. I love Love Actually. I love freaking Titanic. Moulin Rouge is one of my favorite. I am not a cold-hearted guy, but there's other ways they could have approached this romance And the way they do it here, I get it. They were trying to go for the funny, but it just didn't land for myself. It was the parts in between those sections that I loved about this film. So overall, I was entertained. As I put in my review, I was entertained, but not always engaged in the film.
I think that's a really good way to put it. And that's, again, you guys are kind of like echoing my sentiments, but not with nearly enough disdain. Jeff, I'm going to get to you last on the panel because I'm building up the tension.
I know Mike Crowley. Like, it's good to cut to Mike right now. Mm-hmm. I know okay, Mike just...
Oh, boy. So I liked it. It's definitely a good summer blockbuster. It's like a perfect date movie you can bring someone to. I thought the dialogue, like you guys were saying, it was pretty corny. There's especially that scene when they light Ryan Gosling on fire and throw him up against the wall a million times. And he's saying to the director saying to him, well, maybe if this actor felt this way, you know, you'd feel that way about me. And they're trying to say it like it's the other actor doing that. And then Ryan Gosling goes, well, maybe we've spent more time together. Anyways, there was stuff like that that made me cringe. The action slash trying to rescue Aaron Taylor Johnson part, that did not work so well for me. I was actually more invested in the romance between Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt. And that might be because it's easy for these two to have chemistry. They're two of the best looking actors in Hollywood. So naturally they would levitate towards each other. The action, I mean, it was kind of just, it didn't stand out from anything because I think the bar has been set so high for movies like John Wick and Monkey Man that when you see this, it's like, oh, it's another car, you know, flying over something and something exploding. And that would make sense. This guy directed like Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw, which he's the writer of it.
No, he directed it as well.
He directed it too.
No, yeah, that's somebody.
He did.
Else
no, he, it's on David looking Leach? At IMDb okay, gotcha, right now. You.
I'm looking at the writer's credits.
Yeah, I thought it was
the writer's credits.
I thought I was going crazy for a second.
No, you got it. You got it. My bad.
No.
I love you, Don.
But it's funny. Hobbs and Shaw, did that one have a lot of like car chases in it, or was that one just like,
it's a Fast and the Furious movie.
I know, but they could just
There were vehicle chases.
Yeah, so this guy knows how to handle all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's fun, but there's a certain point in the movie where it reaches a climax and you think, okay, it's gonna be over. But then it keeps going with another climax, and then you're going, wait, when is this thing going to end? How's it going to end?
Mike, and we got to talk past the first 20 minutes. Come on. no, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, some of that dialogue in that scene I mentioned earlier was just absolutely horrendous. So, but it's not dialogue I haven't seen in a million other movies before.
It does. You know, I know it's based on a 50-year-old TV show, but damn it, it really does. Or, you know, 45. It does feel like a lot of it was taken from TV or old, you know, scripts, things that we've seen a million times before. All right, Jeff, let's have it.
I think this is the biggest major studio misstep as far as launching a property since Universal failed with the darker version of The Mummy and Tom Cruise. And what I mean by that are a couple of things. For starters, if you're going to do the Fall Guy, and it's a very famous television series, it was very popular, ran for 6 seasons in the early 80s, do the show. The thing that made the show fun wasn't that he was a stuntman. Mm-hmm. We've all seen that. We've all seen the behind-the-scenes stuff on 1,000 Blu-rays, et cetera, et cetera. The fun of it was that to make ends meet, he had to moonlight as a bounty hunter. And as a bounty hunter, he was able to incorporate Hollywood stunts and gags and things like that into that world. So if you're just in this world, it's not enough. We've been there before, and you better make it damn good. They didn't. Guys, I'm sorry. I disagree with you wholly on this. There wasn't one stunt in there that looked real. It was all shot, edited, color graded, and, you know, put together. It looked fake. And I'll give you the biggest start of it and give you a good example of the way they could have done it and should have done it. So we have this big setup where the Colt Seaver's character is going up, and we don't know what he's quite doing, but then he does this backwards fall and he goes all the way down, and that's where he breaks his back. Burt Reynolds, of all people, did a similar kind of stunt in the 1985 movie Stick. mm-hmm. and it looked incredible. And Dar Robinson was the stunt guy, and he shot in slow motion, and he shot it from an angle that you could see this man was plunging backwards 50 feet before, you know, they cut right when you see there's going to be a bag there. That's how you do it. There wasn't one stunt in this film that made it look like, in fact, when they show in the end credits, all the real stunts being done, okay, that's kind of interesting because that looked more real than anything I saw in the movie. So for a movie that's supposed to be making, you know, kind of glorifying the stuntman and all that kind of stuff, I couldn't believe how badly it was shot. And Leach is an ex-stunt guy, but he makes it look, I think there were some times when he was almost flutter cutting or step printing or something to make it look faster, and it looked stupid. But if you're going to do banter between two characters, you have to have smart banter. You just can't have bitchy banter. And after the first three times that they threw him against the wall, which, by the way, he just came off of a broken back, but go ahead, fly in a bad seat for 18 hours to Sydney and then be thrown against a wall, which his director, whether she's mad at him or not, would not make him do. I know you're saying, Jeff, it's a comedy lineup. No, because this is the premise of the show. Mm-hmm. And it's just ridiculous that they flop him around like that. But anyway, they do this banter back and forth where they're paraphrasing through the characters about the problems of the room. It's like, don't these people know about what happened to each other? He broke his back on a movie that she was making, and she's mad at him for what? Walking away from, he ruined his career, ruined his life and all that kind of stuff. And it's not funny. And it gets labored after the third time. I get it. And then they have him hit the wall six more times and do the shtick six more times. It's a mess all over the place. Hedda Waddington, a double Emmy winner, is embarrassing in it. She's overacting in every scene. Leach is not good with actors. He made the same mistakes in Bullet Train. Everybody is pitched at an 11. Mm-hmm. And when you've got the cinematography and the editing and the color grading and the performances all at 11, and then you've got a script that's a 5, you know, oh, we're going to have them have this fun, bitchy banter. Too bad they didn't say one witty thing in that entire two-hour movie.
What about real spicy romance. Margaritas, Jeff? Spicy
margaritas. And they keep hitting that joke over and again.
That's it wasn't enough,
the first time or the sixth time. Or how about the dog chomping on the balls? I think that was in there at least 5 or 6 times, cool. too. It's like, really? I think, didn't we kind of get rid of that as far as a novelty back in the Stooges days? I'm shocked.
No, Jeff, because he hit people in the balls if he was commanded to do so in French. That's the...
Yeah. That makes it auteur shit, Jeff. That's fancy.
That gives it that new spin.
I found entertainment in that one.
They did one better than the Farrelly brothers.
I enjoyed that gimmick.
There's something about Mary. So for me, I just sat there thinking, this feels labored. It feels fake. I think it's lacking wit. It doesn't even really have much sex appeal, as good as those two are. And they are attractive. They are great together. They had more bitchy repartee and wit and sex appeal together in 2 minutes presenting at the Oscars than they did in 2 hours here. So to me, it's just a complete bust. And by the time they get to the plot, and here's the question I'll just ask for the panel. You know, I'm not trying to take your show, but like, you're flying a stuntman with a broken back 18 hours across the globe to be set up as the fall guy for this accidental death when you've got 50 other crew members around that you could point the finger at, but you're going to make sure that he's the guy. And like, how long is that body on ice? I mean, just, it's ludicrous. Find a better plot point to get him over to Australia, but don't make that it. It's kind of a buzzkill too, because it's dark and mean. And it's like, oh, so now we're supposed to, and then who is the Aaron Taylor Johnson character? Is he Tom Cruise? Is he just a typical Matthew McConaughey seemed to be doing an imitation of him. But why, if it's an accidental death, why not just say it's an accidental death? But instead, you know, he's not a murderer. So I don't understand why this whole plot was even in existence, especially when it would have been funny to see Ryan Gosling walk around going, oh, my back. And then he's trying to get these guys who are tough-ass Danny Trujillo types. Mm-hmm. And he has to fake being hit. So he's like knocked out, and then when they think, oh, he's knocked out, then he gets up and clobbers them or whatever else the heck that Lee Majors did on the show. That should have been the movie, and that would have been funny because Gosling plays the coward very well, as we know from The Nice Guys. And here, I don't know what he's playing. He's playing a fool in love, but other than that, I don't know. So that's my 5 minutes. Sorry.
I dig it.
No, I mean, I hadn't really thought about that angle, Jeff, of the contrivance of getting him over to Australia, because the whole conceit is they were going to use deepfake technology to paste his face onto the killer or onto Aaron Taylor Johnson to make it look like he was the one who did it. You could literally do that with anyone.
Exactly.
Performer number 7. You don't need the old guy. Yeah.
Right. Plot point.
Ian, your turn. Come on, hit it.
Well, I mean, you guys are, again, you're all kind of hitting it right on point, except not with nearly enough rage.
That's right.
I was rageful a week ago. Now I'm just
laughing about it's weird because I saw it a week ago. I actually went on a Wednesday night because we didn't have a live show last week. So I went on a Wednesday because I had like an early sneak preview.
Yeah.
So I saw that. So it's kind of hazy in my memory, but it's all coming back to me now, as the great Stephen once said. Let's go back to the trailer. Great teaser, I think. You know, it had momentum. It had sex appeal, romance, action. I really got the sense that this is going to be a high octane, kind of sweet and funny movie starring two, you know, really fine movie stars. Mm-hmm. But then I saw the second trailer, and I didn't want to, but I was at some, you know, movie screening because, you know, point of fact, I pay to go see movies now. I used to be, I'm still,
hey, you're like me.
Right. but you know, because of geography and jobs and time and all that stuff, I don't go see the press screenings anymore. So I have to sit through trailers. And so if they decide to take a really tight 2-minute trailer and expand it to, I don't know, 4.5 minutes and show everything in the film that would have been a nice surprise to discover during the screening, then it's just like, I don't know if I want to see this movie anymore. But I was curious, so I did. Now, the whole point of the trailer is these two people are in love. This guy wants to impress this this director on this set, but they had some kind of a history together, and so she doesn't quite, you know, she's not digging him anymore. But he ends up being recruited to go after the missing movie star, Aaron Taylor Johnson, who turns up dead in a bathtub. And then there's bad guys chasing him because of what Johnson's character is involved in, all this stuff. Very exciting, very cool. It took an hour to get to the point where there is even the dead body in the bathtub.
Yeah.
If you had not seen that trailer, it would have been a big surprise. I don't even know if it'd be a welcome surprise.
I mean, that
to
would
see
be,
this
you know,
plot point. Yeah. Because you, again, it's this, it starts off as one movie, and I don't have a problem with, you know, a romantic action comedy. I just think that you have to know what audience you're catering to, because this was way more chick flick than it was action movie. And the dirty little secret is that women love action movies, you know, possibly not for the same reason that guys do, but you know, they're exciting. They're fun. They have, you know, chiseled half naked dudes running around saving the world and sometimes the girl, and that's fun for everybody. Mm-hmm. But in this case, you know, with that accident that opens the film with Colt Seavers doing a dive backwards off of this, you know, the interior of this tall building, horribly shot, because you literally see him descend and then you cut to black. And then it's like, oh, he's in, you know, physical rehab, you know, 6 months or 18 months later or whatever. Mm-hmm. And we're told that he broke his back on that and his career was lost. It's all done through voiceover. There is nothing there. That should have been a really exciting, intense moment showing this carefree guy who's kind of in love with the girl. He thinks he's best bros with the actor, and his whole career has been great. And he's got this bright future ahead of him. And then tragedy happens. You should have seen the ropes snap, or do the wee thing of it like not catching when it was supposed to catch, and he's falling all the way down. It should have been a terrifying moment, right? It's not. We're told what happened later, and then you're right with the recovery. He gets a job as a valet at this, you know, uptight club, and he ends up doing the thing that has become a trope in superhero movies the last few years, which I think is really distasteful: turning heroes into anti-heroes when we're supposed to think of them as virtuous heroes. He does the thing that Superman did in Man of Steel, where he takes the truck driver and puts his rig up in the power line pole because he insulted him, not even because they got in a fight at the bar. It wasn't Superman 2 we're talking about. Captain Marvel, you know, the guy says, you know, why don't you smile, lady, and she ends up like beating up and taking his motorcycle. In this, the guy makes he's a dick, but he makes some offhanded comments like, hey, you used to be a huge stunt guy. I used to work with you. And what happened to you? And he ends up doing like donuts and stuff around the parking lot and busting up the guy's car. I'm like, I liked this guy 5 minutes ago, but now I don't know who he is.
Right.
And then when we get to the Australia set, turns out Emily Blunt, who Ryan Gosling thought had requested him by name, she had no idea he was coming. It was all a setup on the set of the part of the senior production, like stunt coordinator guy.
And so they end up having Winston this Duke, who could do
and she shows more. No concern about his physical well-being, even if she's mad at him because she felt that he pushed her out and all that. Who wouldn't understand that? I'm sorry, but to your point, Ian, if we had seen him actually being taken out on the gurney and realizing maybe my career is over or maybe I'll never walk again, and she's sitting there crying about it, maybe we see him going through rehab and she's there, but then he starts to get cold and moody and grumpy and kind of pushes her away, then all that might have made some sense. But instead, she's just this arrogant, you know, entitled and sort of living in her own bubble world that she can't understand what he's been through or why he maybe did some of the things he did, let alone why he's even there. And she's throwing him against the wall, against the rocks to break his back again. It's these characters are inexplicable.
I don't mind the shorthand they try if it can go somewhere. Like, I know the bullhorn scene is a rough one to like be the place that is somewhere that you're getting to with their, where their relationship is and the rewind of all that. I don't mind the shorthand of that if that's a little more core of the movie, but of course everything after that is pure shenanigans. So
because I don't feel like it's true to people. I mean, if they really cared about each other, we don't know. First of all, it's so choppy. We don't know how long they had carried on this friendship across several movies that kind of butted into, you know, an almost romance, you know, kind of thing. It seems like they were on the cusp of having a relationship when the accident happened. Jeff Aldea one better. She's crying. He's getting, you know, taken away on the gurney. There's a touching hospital scene where he's like, the doctors say it's going to be 2 years before I ever can do anything again. My career's over. And she's like, well, you know, I'm sorry. I'm getting called away because my big shot just happened. I'm going to go be on a movie with Aaron Taylor Johnson's character. 2 years, you know, no hard feelings. We'll keep in touch, whatever. Mm-hmm. 2 years later, they're separated by circumstance. They have to rekindle things, except, oh, wait, now she's in a relationship with our Matthew McConaughey, who, by the way, is mixed up in a criminal underworld enterprise.
Yeah.
Colt Seavers. Let's just go the bounty hunter route. He ends up having to go after him, which puts her life and career in jeopardy.
Now we're talking.
I'm writing the movie.
It's a better story right off the bat.
Not as predictable as what we actually got.
And we've seen movies kind of like that before, but there is a reason that those things kind of work, and it's all in how you handle the specifics of it that could make it work. Instead of this, where that scene with the whole throwing against the wall stuff, it paints her in a terrible light because she's like, oh yeah, after you wouldn't return my phone calls, I became an alcoholic. I slept with so many men. I'm like, is that supposed to be cool? And you got all the women on the set like nodding along like, yeah, we wanted to be whores too. I'm like, what are you doing here?
It's crazy.
It's not good.
It's crazy. Can I say one other thing to it? And this is one of those nuanced things that I know maybe we can't deal with the nuance when we've got such big broad strokes to paint in first. But I would dare say that the modern stunt work that is worth lauding and sort of the stuff that stands out today is not this typical shit that they're showing here, which they showed in the 1982 credits for the Fall Guy, you know, the pickup truck jumping and rolling cars. I mean, it's right even in the lyrics there. That stuff has been around since Steve McQueen was racing around San Francisco in Bullet. There's nothing exciting or new about any of that. What is exciting and new? Oh, 62-year-old Tom Cruise and 63-year-old Keanu Reeves are doing all their own stunts, and they're doing it in 20 to 30 second pieces where we don't cut to show that it's actual choreography.
Right.
That's what stunt work is today. It's choreography, and it's brilliant choreography because one false move, it looks fake, and you got to start all over, and you got to do all the energy at that same pitch for the next take, and that's 30 seconds without cutting too. Things like that would have been more exciting to show as far as representing it and seeing how that is done behind the scenes. But this movie doesn't even have faith in the stunt work they're showing. They have so little faith in behind the scenes movie making that every time they're showing that action sequence in that sci-fi movie, they bring in this, oh, here's what it will look like when it's finished and color corrected and all the sci-fi and CGI is put in there. They don't even have faith in the behind the scenes story that this movie is ostensibly all about, that they say, well, shit, we better show how cool it's going to look ultimately because everybody's going to think this looks terrible and cheap and everybody's wearing rubber masks. I mean, did Leach think, oh, maybe that's a disservice to the stunt folks I'm trying to glorify here, because what I'm ending up glorifying are all those tech wizards who do it in the post. I couldn't believe that.
Fair wonder.
Well, Jeff, listen, I mean, if you wanted,
I protest too much.
I'm updating the script, the premise. Okay.
There you go.
Why does Colt Seavers become a bounty hunter? It's because in a world where stunts used to be king, now you can do a lot of stuff with CGI.
Yeah,
there's less demand. The quality of the stunt people perhaps is not getting, you know, it's deteriorating or something, or the studio feels that there's no need for practical stunts where they can just do it in post or do it in the computer. Right. And so they cut his hours. He finds he can't support himself anymore. So what? He becomes a bounty hunter. And you know what? Maybe he gets a set decorator to come along with him because they're doing all that, and you know, now too, they're helping him with those little elaborate schemes.
See, that would be funny. They set up like cons, and he pretends to get hit and hurt, and you know, she's creating these fake rooms just like they did in The Sting. Remember where they go into the one room and they pretend they're painting it, and then it has to be the that kind of stuff would have been hilarious.
The unemployed A team from Hollywood. There you go.
Oh, yeah. See, that's funny. The unemployed A team, like, and then the costume designer or the lighting person sitting around going, I just don't like the lighting here. Shh, we'll worry about that later. You're last on our list.
Yeah.
Why did I get to watch that movie?
There's a workplace comedy version of this that's an action comedy, of course, but there's a workplace comedy version of this that is more meta to the movies, more meta to the more specific versions of movies we're making now. You still pepper the romance. You still have a little Scooby-Doo whodunit kind of thing without murder and mayhem. You know, it doesn't have to go that hard.
They probably didn't go there because FX did. Remember when FX came out with Brian Dennehy and Brian?
Oh, Brown? Yeah.
That was kind of a similar thing where he was using his SX, his SF, special effects, whatever you call it.
Yeah.
To get those guys. But that was also 40 years ago. Nobody would remember that. So just do it. I mean, that's the better story with Ian's story right there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what surprised FX.
Sorry, go ahead, Mark.
What surprised me with the film was just how much of their romance we got before the movie actually gets to the movie part. Mm-hmm. When I saw the trailer, while it wasn't of interest to me, I thought, oh, okay, they mentioned that they're a fling. So it was a very brief thing. They did have a relationship fling sort of thing going on. And we're going to get that in little bits and pieces of a flashback, at least. I didn't expect us to actually focus on a lot of their prior relationship, you know, especially in the beginning of the film. I think that took a bit away from it. I think another angle, if you still want to do the romance angle, do the lost puppy angle to where... Yeah. You never actually got to where she was acknowledging his feelings. They were just friends on set. He always had the crush, the love. Then he has the accident just before, say, he was going to ask her out on an actual date. He has the accident. He disappears while they're good friends. You can still get that riff. Then he comes back for this opportunity for possibly his second chance at her and win her over, and that way she could still be fairly stoic towards him and almost like not even recognize that he's there, because they play it quite a bit, a theme in the section of the film. The dialogue plays that quite a bit, that no one will notice the stuntman is there. So you play that angle to where she's still not quite noticing him, and he's pining for her, and then she asks him to go look for their main actor. And he's like, okay, I'm going to go use this to prove myself to her, and do it from that angle. You could still work in your romance, but it makes it feel a little bit more believable. And you could even have maybe some of the awkward dialogue work a little better. But the fact that they were supposed to have known each other for so long and you get this dialogue, again, I hate keep coming back to it, but that was the one thing that stuck out to me, was just the way their dialogue and banter was written made me sigh. I'm like, are these high schoolers? I get what they're going for. It fell so flat.
Where's the pity? Where's the pity for Colt in this movie? I mean, another funnier idea, just to build off what you're saying, Mark, and maybe what you were saying, Ian, too, is maybe she hires him out of pity because she's still his friend, but she hires him to do all this lame stuff that doesn't really challenge him at all. But then the real adventure and his real danger, physical danger, comes when he's doing the bounty hunter stuff or something else. But I mean, shocked that nobody thinks that this man with those big rods in his back is, you know, shouldn't be there at all. Instead, she's rather using it to work out her angry agenda as a Me Too woman or something. Mm-hmm. It's like, what in the hell is this movie about?
it's an opening for a classic Superman Clark Kent thing, like the yeah. date scene in Superman mm-hmm. 4.
Yeah,
you know, one of the only redeeming things about Superman 4, where it's a double date and Clark is constantly like coming into the apartment where Superman's flying out the window and all this other mm-hmm. stuff. You could have that with Colt trying to be on set to do what he's trying to do. Well, also, you know, he's just mm-hmm. he's speeding onto the set and screeching into his parking space because he's fresh off of a car chase with somebody else. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I do want to pull over for a second and read some of these chats because we got a lot of them. Okay. So, yeah.
Hopefully it's not my David friends Will. Going after me.
No. David Wilt says, movie remakes of old TV shows are so iconic because you take an old TV show that people used to watch and create your own version of it. Oh, they created their own version of the Fall Guy. True. I don't tell you that much. One thing, I did a show last week with David Fowley about The Fugitive, the 1993 yeah. Andrew Davis movie. And they make a couple of references to The Fugitive in The Fall Guy. And as I told David, I had the Will Smith moment. I said, you keep The Fugitive out of your mother effing mouth. Because that is how you make a TV show that, you know, at that point it was like 30 years old. So it was like, well, we'll adapt it. But there was no talk of like a franchise. I mean, yes, they've made U.S. Marshals, but The Fugitive is a tight standalone movie that respects the premise of the original and completely updates it to 1990 sensibilities and makes it a real thrilling banger of a movie. Yeah, I mean, to your point, Mark, I know I'm getting off on a tangent here, but the whole romance and dialogue thing, the dialogue was terrible. But the main problem was it kept starting and stopping the movie. They'd have an 8-minute conversation punctuated by a 10-minute action scene and another 8-minute conversation. It's all like, you know, why did you leave? Well, you know, why didn't you stick around for me? Why did you leave? Why didn't you stick around? You know, I don't know how I feel.
Get me up to date on the plot. Right. Here's what we know. Oh, really? Is that what you know? Yes. And we also know this. I mean, how much of that was in here?
Hey, it was a nice gimmick with the split screen. That distracted me for about...
Oh, God. You just reminded me of that scene.
I mean, they were covering a lot of exposition in that dialogue.
That's true.
Which is also bad. That's writing 101, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted to really make the romance story interesting, they could have taken the bounty hunter angle. And what if she becomes his bounty for some reason, and then he doesn't want to go out and get her, and they still have this romance? Like, that would add a lot to the tension and to the stakes than what's here, which seems just kind of like empty a lot of times, you know.
Well, hell, Mike, you're giving me more ideas. Okay, imagine this is an actual production. Like, if it's supposed to be, let's say it's not even like a space alien movie, but like a Mission Impossible type movie, where they're going to different locations, different countries. They're kind of like having to hack up and go to different places. And so they're getting into adventures and misadventures and hijacking or hostage situations, whatever, in New York or Australia or, you know, Hong Kong or something like that. Make it a truly international feel. It's like, once we get to Australia, we're just kind of stuck there. It's kind of one of the reasons I didn't like that. Oh my God, what was that? Wreck-It Ralph?
Right.
Where it's like, oh, we've got hundreds of movie, video game properties, but we're going to spend 80% of the movie in this one boring game.
I'm the opposite, where I think the easier and smaller version of this movie can just be in and around Hollywood. You know, like,
it could be, but if it's better,
especially if he's doing the valet thing where, like, you know, I'm not saying he has informants and it starts getting hunched, but like, where he just knows his way around town, he knows enough people in town, and like, hey, we're looking for, you know, Tony, whatever. And like, have you seen him a little bit? Oh, no, check the frolic room, you know, like, you know, just like, you could kind of just do this in LA and keep it low, and you don't need Sydney and you don't need millions of dollars, and you can walk off a set where this feels more like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in terms of like the working, everyone knows each other at work, you know, like the way, you know, Brad Pitt shows up and kicks Bruce Lee's ass, like little stuff like that, where like everybody knows the ins and outs of town. And it's just a matter of finding the guy you need and little, you know, there's just a smaller version that stays right there. But the international version would play just fine too if you need it to be bigger and better. So I get it.
It could be the small guy. There you go. David Wilt again says, I think that one of the very first movie remakes of a TV show was the 1987 movie Dragnet. Old serious crime drama turned into a comedy. I don't think I ever saw that.
I loved that
Tom
movie.
Tom Hanks and Dan Aykroyd.
Dan Aykroyd and Tom Hanks.
Dean Siskel tried to get Dan Aykroyd an Oscar nomination for that movie. He was very funny in it. Yeah.
It was another one of those. It was a precursor to what you got with a very Brady movie, is that they took the character from the 50s and they put him in modern day. So Dan Aykroyd plays the nephew, I think it is, of Joe Friday.
Okay. But he acts like Joe Friday
from the 50s. He acts like that guy from the 50s, the way he dresses and everything, and very strict, and everybody else is more 80s cop film. And that was funny, that was hilarious. Mm. Because of the way that I love that film, I love the soundtrack. I've got it. I play it often.
I'll have to check out Dragnet. I remember it being a thing when I was 10 when it came out, so I had no connection to the show. But no, that's going on the list.
Yeah.
David Wilt also says, intro to the TV show. It included a scene from the 72 disaster classic, The Poseidon Adventure.
Yeah.
Oh, was generally
the greatest single fall stunt at the time was the last shot, which sets all the lights in the party room off, because he falls from hanging onto this table into the skylight below, which is now on the floor. And it's point of view from kind of the same thing that they tried to do with Gosling here, but it was done real, just like Dar Robinson falling in stick, and we knew how to shoot it. Here's a stuntman director who doesn't know how to shoot most of his stunts.
Or all he knows now is making it look too good, the way you're talking about. Like, the skill set now is the polish you spoke on earlier of, like, we need to cover it with this, cover it with that color, you know, and just like paint it with this, shape it like that, choreograph it like that. That's the modern game, which kind of isn't stunt making, like you said.
They could have easily spun this, even if they wanted to do the ode to stuntmen, spin it as a period piece. I mean, we're getting these now to where they're films set in a decade. They're not slapping you in the face like anymore, like saying, hey, look, we're in the 80s, but look at Love Lies Bleeding. Didn't realize it was going to be a late 80s film till I started watching it. I'm like, okay, they could have did this and set this in the late 80s. You don't have the cell phones, because that's the only thing that really takes away is the cell phone.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you could play towards the actual stunts still needing to be a thing. Plus, let's give props to Charles Brand. Fucking Metal Storm is actually the fake movie they're making here, which is a reference to the 80s Metal Storm film. Don't give me the Fall of Jared Sin. Come on.
Marcus, is a salient one, because even as a sci-fi genre, the computer effects and After Effects would probably be where they'd be creating most of the monsters running after them. It's not going to be done with 50 stunt guys with bad rubber faces on and stuff. It's just, that's not how those are done. So to your point, if it was a period piece, or like a John Wick movie where, you know, he's got to go into a museum and fight off 30 guys with machetes or swords or guns or whatever, that's where the stunt work is today. It's not in this stuff that you can easily create after as After Effects.
Yeah,
Jeff, can you imagine how fun it would be for Colt Seavers to have to go into a museum, as you're saying, and fight off a horde of 50 like black suit clad guys with Uzis and katana blades for this movie party's doing, but the people who are after him have also sent their own mini army of black clad people with Uzis and katana blades, and they all get mixed in together.
Yeah.
So you don't know who's got the real weapons and is trying to kill him.
That's a great scene. And he doesn't know it. We know it, but he doesn't know it. So he's treating them all the same. And then, like, when somebody actually cuts him, he's like, hey, aren't we going to cut? There's, you know, a little bit of blood here. And then, you know, he realizes that that's the real person, but he can't figure out which one it is because they're all dressed the same. You know, that would be funny.
Maybe speaking of the camaraderie, the community of the stunt, you know, the stunt family this movie is allegedly trying to pay homage to, he knows all the people that are on the stunt crew. And he also knows that there's a whole bunch of other people he doesn't recognize. So he's trying to protect the people that he knows in this melee, all Terminator 2 style. Like, I'm not going to let this person get, you know, I'll shoot this guy in the head, but this other guy won't get shot. And they're like, I don't know what I'm talking about. This movie has been described as a love letter to stunt films, and I say, like most love letters, they are poorly written. All right, so
if that's love, I'd hate to see hate.
Jiwa.
So Jiwa, eating my tuna sandwich, half of it, from Stop One Deli before I start my indie film news show in a bit. So dropping by for a bit of this show. Well, thank
hopefully
you.
Hopefully it will inspire you.
Fall Guy from the 1980s? That's like 100 years ago before the French Revolution.
Thanks.
That might they well, might as well enjoy. Remake the Citizen Kane Man movie. I want to see Citizen Kane Man. What is that? That guy, like his emblem is a sled. Apparently, this is the old man club show. That's cool. Oh. Ladies are busy. Listen,
Mike is not that old.
Yeah, wow. You'd be surprised. Not like the rest of us here, Mike. Man.
I never felt so old when somebody at work said, "Oh, John Hughes, he makes old movies." Like those are the 80s. It's like, yeah, that's 50 years ago.
Andy's dead. Right. Oh, no, okay. And also, your comment about the ladies, Sujiwa, if you had been here since the beginning of the show, not like the beginning of time,
that's been the other
you would know that we had plans for Katie to come on, but she's not feeling well. So, and she's a huge defender of this movie. So I'm kind of glad she's not here to see this evisceration, or maybe she would have put us to shame with her knowledge. The people were busy watching Cosmic Disco Detective Renee on YouTube, not the Fall Guy at theaters at 200,000 plus views now. Woohoo! Oh, yes, congratulations on that runaway success. And he pops in here with a super chat. Thank you very much. $10.
Wow.
Damn. Keep up the good work. Thanks for reading all of my many, many comments in past shows. Good panel. I think that's a dig at the fact that this came in a long time ago. So you probably had no confidence we were ever going to read these. but good panel. Thank you. That's $2 each for the five panel members.
All
right.
Putting it all in one place, boys. Yeah.
That workplace comedy version is like Mission Impossible movies doing mass sliding sets, etc. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You can go that easy with it. It doesn't have to be complicated.
Emily Blunt as love interest? Okay, I guess. Frowny face.
I mean, she's the most overqualified karaoke singer we can all agree in. Like,
well, and that's what you do as a director when you get a lucky break at 4 o'clock in the afternoon is you go and you don't have anything to prep for the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, just I know they're going to say, well, people don't want to watch that. It's like, but you're making a movie about movies and you don't even trust us to watch the scene without having to show it as finished CGI. It's just absurd. I mean, that's where you want to talk to the guy and say, you are a stuntman, right? Because you realize that insults what you're showing of the stunt work. Right.
And on top of it, insults Phil Collins' classic Against All Odds. I love that song unabashedly. Yeah. I love the music video. And I had heard someone say
that there's
an homage to Against All Odds in this movie. I didn't realize they were just talking about they played the song in like kind of a mashup, montage thing.
Yeah, yeah.
The music video for the 1982 movie with Phil Collins is more exciting than this movie, especially the car chase scene with James Woods and Jeff Bridges. Maybe a good regular actress like that lady from Summer Nordic Bear movie may have been better. Yes, Florence Pugh.
Yes.
What's this?
Midsummer.
Yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Sorry.
I like Summer Nordic Bear movie though. That's better.
Like Arnold's take on it.
Yeah.
Summer Nordic Bear movie. Florence Pugh. She must have farted a lot. Her family is a long line of farters.
There's a bear pew in the woods. Anyway, I think I like the idea of Emily Blunt swapping places with Florence Pugh because then you'd still have the Oppenheimer connection. Now, when you mentioned Sujua, Emily Blunt as a romantic interest, okay, I guess. Let me point to a movie that this film should have been, that Emily Blunt was also in, that was very exciting, at times funny and kind of, oddly romantic in its own way, featuring Tom Cruise, Edge of Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
She kicked so much ass in that movie. Yes, it was a sci-fi version of Groundhog Day, but I mean that montage where Tom Cruise keeps like getting killed over and over again because she's trying to teach him how to survive, and she's just getting so frustrated. And at one point, she just like comes and shoots him in the head. She's like, "I'm done with this." That was better than anything that she was able to do in this movie. Not a detriment to her, but the screenplay.
I'm trying to scatter through the filmography quick. Have we seen a properly Emily Blunt proper Emily Blunt
nude romantic scene?
Drama. No.
Sorry.
Romantic drama or romantic comedy. Like, I know she's the second fiddle office bitch in Devil Wears Prada, where she's not the lead, a romantic lead. Mary mm-hmm. Poppins is pretty chaste. I don't think she's got a rom-com on the resume that kind of says, whoa, that's the attainable thing I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. I don't think she's got one.
Not a rom-com. I mean, she did. It's weird because she was also in.
I wouldn't count Edge of Tomorrow in there at all either.
No, but I was thinking of the boat, the Disney boat movie with The Rock.
Oh, Jungle Cruise.
Yeah, I mean,
but see, that one is really again. They're not really romance either. It's,
yeah,
it was more like Sam and Diane fighting, but there's no Sam and Diane loving.
She was in a Wild Mountain Time.
That's an awful movie. If you've seen it, it's rough.
But I mean, that's
the closest.
If you want, to talk about a romance film, looking at her filmography,
I don't see one.
Her later stuff, her earlier stuff, maybe a little bit more. You got your sister's sister, the Young Victoria,
or it's him again. Like a Justin Bieber with Damon, it's a sci-fi movie first, a couple movie second.
But you also bring up an interesting point in the idea of romantic comedy or adventure romance, as this is, and maybe ostensibly the Jungle Cruise movie was as well. They seem to be pulling their punches on the romance part.
Oh, yeah.
Even though you have the female lead and supposed to have all this chemistry and stuff, these two spend most of this film explaining the plot to each other. Mm-hmm. And there's very little sense of real romance or connection to them. And then when they finally do kind of get on the same page, he keeps saying, and we're going to beat the shit out of them, right? And so you don't have it even there. And it's like, I don't know if they thought, well, you know, the young 11-year-olds out there aren't going to go for that. But where the heck is this supposed romance between these two? When they get the opportunity, they don't do anything with it either.
I found the one.
I mean, hell.
2012, 5-year engagement. The follow-up with Siegel to Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Like, that was the one semi-romantic lead she did. And it was a bomb.
There was a follow-up to Forgetting Sarah Marshall?
Not like a, like, it was the same director.
His second director, his next movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought it was this, like, what?
No. That's a lot. That's 12
Forgetting years. The Sarah Marshall follow-up.
Yeah.
Following Sarah Marshall. We talked about, on this show, Romancing the Stone, we talked about a while ago. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of chemistry you need, the action adventure romance.
Yeah,
so good. You know, it's weird because David Leitch, he directed, I'm not the hugest fan of the Fast and the Furious movies, but I really had a lot of fun with Hobbs and Shaw.
Okay.
And I really loved Deadpool 2 more than I liked the first Deadpool, honestly. And I'm like, but I didn't like anything really about The Fall Guy. And I think it has to come down to the screenplay, you know, because those other two movies they're fun, they're kinetic, they're witty, they're dark when they need to be. This movie just was just all gloss and surface. And it was almost like they were trying to parody some of our blockbusters by making a really bad one and constantly making references to other movies that I wish I were watching instead of this one. It has no identity. It's kind of like, you know, the 2000s, honestly. All we can do is reference other pop cultural, you know, tent poles or mile markers instead of coming up with our own. I want to just acknowledge Petty's back in the house with a super chat. Thank you very much, Petty. Greetings to all. Mark, this one's for you. The best thing about the movie is Jean-Claude, the dog steals the movie.
I like the dog bit. I like the dog bit.
I liked the first time. The fifth time, I was like, just, you know.
If only he had stolen the movie and run away with it 10 minutes into it and never returned.
He kind of reminds me of the dog from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
He went for the nuts, too.
Yeah, that's right.
They could at least have called him Chopper and told him his sick balls. I don't know. That's just, Edge of Tomorrow is great. There you go.
A movie we can all agree upon.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, and a movie I need to watch again. I saw that once, and I think I've owned it twice, like on DVD and Blu-ray, but I haven't revisited it since, what is that, 10 years ago now?
By this point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My goodness. All right. I'm just checking my notes here.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I don't have anything else to say about this movie. Oh, I do.
Okay.
It was brought up earlier. And I'm going to give a shout-out to friend and colleague Lee Showquist. Now, this may be telling stories out of school, but he posted on Facebook. So that's I guess that's somewhat public, yeah. He was talking about what a revelation Hannah Waddington was in this movie. Mm. And he's like, I've never seen her before. I don't know what she's in, but she was amazing in The Fall Guy. She was not. She was atrocious in this movie. And he said that he had never seen Ted Lasso, the Apple Plus TV series, which is where most people came to know and love Hannah Waddington. And I think I would dare say if he were to go and watch that TV show, even just 2 episodes, not even 3 seasons, mm-hmm. watch what she does with that character.
Yes.
And then go back and watch The Fall Guy again and tell me that this is not an embarrassing, like not even a step backwards. This is doing Ryan Gosling's fall at the beginning of this movie and breaking the back of her career. Embarrassing. Mm. She's wearing a funny wig, oversized glasses. She's like, you know, Britney-Britaning it up and all that stuff. Like,
you said it down to 11.
No character.
Yeah, you said it down to 11, you know, too much.
And see, that's also where I think this kind of stuff is in those details on how you direct actors. Because mm-hmm. everybody thinks, oh, if I'm big and broad, I'm funny. But see, the key to comedy mm-hmm. is actors who are playing comedy are actually thinking they're playing drama. Mm-hmm. And that's... That was the biggest advice that Neil Simon gave, other than telling everybody there's no such thing as writing, there's only rewriting. But he said, when I write comedy, even though they're saying funny lines, they can't be aware that they're saying funny lines. And it has to be really dramatic and important. And that's why, like, just for example of California Suite, it worked because Jane Fonda was angry as hell in her part, and Maggie Smith was frustrated and forlorn in her part, and they played it as a drama. They said some very funny lines, and they got the best reviews for it, and Maggie Smith got the Oscar. Richard Pryor and Bill Cosby played the out-of-towners playing tennis, and they're running after each other with tennis racks, and which should be funny enough. And on stage it was, because you had four actors who weren't really known for comedy doing it, and instead you've got Cosby and Richard Pryor going and all that kind of mugging shit. And that's what Hannah Waddington did here. Every line she's like, oh, I'm just doing it with my, and it's like, that's Leach going, you know what, you're gonna be funny because you're so funny in Ted Lasso, do that here. And it's like, that's not what she does in Ted Lasso. She plays it dramatic. And that's the difference.
Yeah. And there's no comedy support either, because Blunt, like we were saying, doesn't have a lot of this in her resume, despite the charm she can have. Gosling normally is, you know, Captain Charisma, but it can't just be him, you know? Maybe your Winston Duke best friend character needs to be, you know, a cheeky comedy guy, not Winston Duke from Us and from Black Panther, you know? Like, I know he's a very gifted actor who can do a lot of things and sing his own little heart out too, but like, but this isn't the spot to have him either. You need some backup here that could swing comedy. You need good old fashioned character actors, not just a collection of stars.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah. Don't it? I think you hit it.
Yeah.
I think it goes back to the script, which Sidrua jumps in saying writing good scripts, especially comedy, is very difficult. All caps. I couldn't agree more. Can't just improvise that stuff on set. Yeah. I think this goes back to something that I kind of hate. When people say about a comedy or a blockbuster, oh, it looked like they were just having so much fun on set. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't want you to have fun on set. I want you to be there to put in the work, to read the lines, mm-hmm. to deliver the performance. Because mm-hmm. oftentimes when it comes to these movies that are describing me like that, I'm watching and thinking, I'm glad someone's having fun with this movie because I'm not. This is dreadful. And I felt the same way about The Fall Guy. We're going to wrap it up here, but Patty asks a very good question. This movie is a girl boss movie? I ask sincerely. I don't think it is.
Not with Ryan Gosling front and center like this. No.
Yeah.
Not a chance.
Well, I mean, Barbie was a girl boss movie, but yes, he did. It's interesting because I think I liked the direction that they were going with this, with Emily Blunt's character starting off. And this is why I think they could have just made a movie about that 2 years between the accident and the setup for this movie, because she starts out as a camera operator mm-hmm. and Ryan Gosling is a stunt guy, and they develop relationships working on movies together, and her ambition is to become a Hollywood director, and she gets her big break, and so she's, you know, kind of ascending the ladder, but the disconnect is in that scene where he's constantly getting set on fire, and she goes on this rant about like how she was the jilted, you know, lover and all that stuff, and she, you know, went around sleeping with men and falling into alcoholism and all this other stuff. That to me is the most, if you want to call it a girl bossy thing, like I don't need no man, and you know, whatever, I'm hurt, so everybody's terrible. But the original setup for the character I think was very sincere and interesting. I'm like, oh, I want to see her make that evolution. What does it take to become a camera operator and then become a director? Mm-hmm. The opening like 15, 20 minutes of this movie, maybe not that, because I think the stunt accident happens. It takes a little while. There's a little bit more set up than that, I think. But I was like, I want to see where these characters are going, what their lives are like, because this is a great setup for a movie. Unfortunately,
it's comedy. Doesn't take much. Yeah.
Right. But unfortunately, it jumps ahead and does some sideways twists to the point where within about another 10 minutes, I'm like, I don't want to spend any more time with these characters anymore. I'm done. So, yeah, I don't think it's a quote unquote girl boss movie. I think I can see how you might get that impression, but it's more nuanced than that. But it's also not good enough to recommend to watch something like that.
Pardon my comment on this, and I'm hoping it's not taken the wrong way. This needed a female writer to go over the script.
Yes, sir.
And look at how it was written. And the reason I say that is,
Holly,
watching, I'm not saying they didn't, I'm not saying it has to be written by a woman. No, I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that it needed to be, because, and maybe it's just me because I watch a lot of indie films, a lot more than most people. You can tell dialogue that was written by a female script writer and a guy writing a woman's parts most of the time. Now, there are exceptions. I'm not going to say that it's a hundred, but most of the time you can tell, and it's usually in the conversation part of it. I'm not saying the whole thing, but in conversation parts, you can tell when a woman has had input on the script because the conversation feels at least a little bit more natural. Mm-hmm. It did not feel like that with the conversations between Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt. It did not feel like this was a relationship conversation. This goes back to, and Jeff, and I hope you don't mind my little shill showing, when we talked about it in Monday night, when we talked about Young Frankenstein. And why Young Frankenstein dialogue worked is because, for what you were saying, they wrote the dialogue and they played it fairly straight, but it was funny because of the situation either it was in or just the way it was possibly delivered, but it was still handled fairly straight, but there's humor in handling the straight dialogue if you direct it properly. And here, I mean, what got me with the trailer, which was, oh, there's a dead guy in the death tub. Oh, he was dead. He was so dead. I'm like, what kind of dialogue is that? And that was him.
12-year-old boy.
That conversation that they have in the truck when he was crying to Taylor Swift music and they were going back and forth, that conversation did not feel like a natural conversation between two ex-folks who still have feelings for each other. It felt like a guy writing, oh, this is going to be so funny.
It felt like dialogue for Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn.
You know, it did not feel like a going for naturally.
Mark's right, though. Get collaboration in the writer's room. Call Nicole Hall of Center to give you a polish when you're done. You know, somebody like that. Go get somebody to kind of once over. Because the improvement in Emily's character would come through. The improvement in Holly Waddington's character would come through. Because, like, you know, hey, she can't be dialed up. Like, you can't tell me a female writer wouldn't tone that down. Make it more nefarious, make it more sneaky and less
I gotta slightly disagree with you guys. It all comes down to who you can't just say get a female writer in there, because female writers wrote Birds of Prey.
Birds of Prey is
a bullshit, man-hating girl boss movie if I ever saw one.
I love Birds of Prey.
You know what? If you're going to make a girl boss movie, which this isn't going to be a girl boss movie, you've got to hate him in a little bit.
No, you don't. I mean, if you're going to make a movie, you got to hate on women a little bit, Don. How does that? No, that sounds like
either way. Depends on the movie.
No, yeah. I'm not saying any female writer. No, but I'm just saying that you get.
Are we talking Jason Voorhees?
You get a talented individual to go over some of this dialogue and just trim it up and the characters a bit.
I think is the key, because I mean, look at, I hate to go back to this movie, but you can go back to the Terminator, the original with Linda Hamilton, James Cameron, you know, worked on, he wrote the script with, I think Gail Ann Hurd was the producer. I don't remember if she had any kind of,
she was very influential on all that.
She was very influential. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. But
she probably, here's the thing. Co-wrote it.
Yeah.
Not getting credit.
It's entirely possible, but to me, I think the key here is that it felt like it was a guy writing a movie that he thought women would want to see. And I think that's a very different thing. And I think that goes back to the rhythm that I was talking about with there's way too much fighting. We got to break for 10 minutes and, you know, have a conversation about our feelings. I'm like, no. And wait a second, Petty. Yes, a mess I made with the question.
Bringing it.
No, it's a good one. It's a very interesting question.
Yeah, I was trying to bring the show to an end, but thank you, Petty. Yeah.
Movies are long. Great dialogue is needed.
This is too climax. It's too long. Perfect. This could be 15, 20 minutes shorter with ease.
Yeah.
Skip everything about the boat and just jump right to the we need to get them recorded on set. Just skip all that shit.
And for the record, I usually like it when a movie has two climaxes at the very least.
Hell.
I'm thinking of Edging of Tomorrow.
I'm thinking of Gaspar Noé, you know.
What? Come again?
Hey, that's the one. It's a sequel to Love.
Oh, good thing Katie's not here. Okay.
she could take it and she dish it out and make us all feel like we want to go. No, I'm not saying that at all. You see, you took it completely. Wow, Don.
Okay.
I'm going to have to clip this out of the live stream. Can I do that? No. Anyway.
That will not be your clip on Instagram tomorrow.
Yeah. Welcome to cancellation, everybody. Anyway, I think that's a good place to leave it. I appreciate you guys hanging out and talking through the Fall Guy with me. I appreciate, you know, you watching out there. We had some viewers and some commenters and some super chats. This has been a very generous live stream on the part of everybody partook. I appreciate it. Next week, join us back here Wednesday at 8 p.m. Central. We're going to be going into the far, far future to hang out with some apes. We're going to see what's going on with the kingdom of the... Okay. Oh, wait a second. Damn it, Petty. What are you doing?
Yeah, especially when he splashes Twinkle Twinkle here. Yeah.
Seriously, Petty. Again with the Super Chats. Thank you so much. Off topic question for last minute. Jeff, do you agree with Jerry Seinfeld's views that the movie business is dead? Oh, my gosh. This is like a six-hour... podcast that you're dropping at 9:07 p.m.
Jeff's middle name is succinct. He's got this.
No, it's just morphing into something different that we could talk about in another show.
Yes.
Ooh, sly answer.
But do you have a succinct thought on this, or is it?
Yeah, I don't think it's dead. I think it's changing and evolving, and it's maybe not going to look exactly like we think it's going to look, or should look, or did look, but it will still be there, but I think it's going to look in very different in a couple of years, and we're already starting to move in that direction. Mm-hmm. So the old way of doing movies, or the old movie look and sort of business, is kind of dissipating, but it's still going to be around, but in a different sort of form.
Yeah.
And
it's up for that show. Huh?
And Petty, I'll add.
Yeah, that'd be a good show.
Petty, I'll add an addendum to Jeff's statement. You're talking about the guy who made the movie about Pop-Tarts. He's talking about that is the movie business dead.
I was waiting for that invite in because I didn't even bother reviewing it.
I'm just saying, this is the guy who literally came off of making a film directly to Netflix about the origins of Pop-Tarts with a bunch of comedians, and he's talking about his movie business dead. It's like Charles Band going, B-movies are horrible, and yet Charles Band has a whole library of B-movies.
It's funny because B-movie starring Jerry Seinfeld was horrible.
You know me. I'm the opposite guy who will go right to the A-list and upper crust. Like, I think Martin Scorsese and $155 million budget movies are ruining the movies just as much as the shit we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. So it's top to bottom changing. Just right.
Well, I'm going to give Petty full credit for when we come and talk about the future of the movies. Cause we nice did a show about
pandemic times. Well, we did a couple.
Yeah. Like 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I think it's time for a revisit, but now it's time to, we got a few more.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for the question.
Great show. See y'all next time. Thank you. Petty says, thanks, Jeff. And you, I think laughing at Mark's popcorn or Pop-Tart comment. That three crying laughing emojis.
You know, before that movie, before Unfrosted, I was like, darn it, I wish I had Pop-Tarts here to eat while I watch this movie. And afterwards, it's like, I think I'll go out and have some pie.
Yeah.
Every time I hear the word pie, I think of I had Christian Slater and True Romance saying I had pie. On
I think of Jason Biggs and a countertop, but you do you.
How about Robert Redford and the way we were? You can't go. I've got steaks. I bought them with all my ration stamps and pie and baked potatoes and it rolls with butter. You can't leave.
Excuse me. Someone said that there would be pie here. There is no pie.
Robert Redford says, "What kind of pie?"
I think of Darren Aronofsky, guy with a drill to his head, which is how I felt at the end of the film. Oh,
nice.
Yeah. And when you were saying pie, I was thinking of that movie as well.
What?
There you go. But Gary is the god of the TV comedy. Well, in certain circles, came out on Netflix, so I don't
always know have Seinfeld.
Larry David is more the 25 years TV ago. Comedy
that's than... the one. That's the one.
Sure, Seinfeld.
Future is also YouTube free movies.
Go to me.
Possibly. Possibly. And then has an authoritative opinion on some topics. Well, that is Jerry Seinfeld. That's very true. Okay, I'm cutting off the comments, you guys. Cars I love you, but I got to let my panelists and myself get some sleep, although I've been drinking coffee all night. I don't know what that's going to mean. But anyway, thanks, everybody out there for watching. Thanks again, you guys, for hanging out. We are Earth's Mightiest Critics. All of your information is down below. So you folks out there, not your information. I don't know what that is, but my esteemed panelists, all their info is down below. Check them out, support them, check out their shows, read their reviews, give them likes and loves and all that good stuff. And join us back next week as we talk about Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Until next time, whenever that is, whatever that is, thanks very much. Take care. And maybe go see the Fall Guy if you get, I guess, but just
watch the TV show.
Watch the TV show. That's much better advice. Yeah. Thank you.